Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
Hey everyone, Jeremy Faust here, your host of ASAP Nowcast, and I am happy to be bringing you the August issue. We are catching up slowly but surely, and let's take a look at the cover here. We have on the cover, the big front and center is the Meet the Candidates for President-elect. That's always a big thing. Voting will be coming up. Not going to get into that, but you always want to know who is on the ballot. And also on the top of this issue, COVID-19 Therapeutics, great article written by Joshua Niferatos, with whom I should mention I work with on Brief 19, a blog that we do together, so that's a little bit of a conflict, although we make no money on it. Anyway, Dr. Niferatos has a great little update, really, of where we are in terms of COVID-19 therapeutics, and the big three, really, that we're covering here would be dexamethasone, remdesivir, and let's just get out there and say it, hydroxychloroquine. I might as well just start with hydroxychloroquine because we just know by now it doesn't work. They've looked at this from the standpoint of prophylaxis, for treatment, for all kinds of different angles, and all the randomized controlled trials have shown nada. So we're kind of done with that, except once in a while in the news cycles it rears its head. Let's really look at the two that matter right now. We're looking at dexamethasone and remdesivir. Dexamethasone, of course, we know a lot about in terms of our practice. As emergency physicians, we use this drug for a lot of different reasons. And now we're learning that for the very sick patients with coronavirus, COVID-19, it has a benefit. Want to be very careful here. Not all comers should be getting dexamethasone. The recovery trial out of the UK did show us very explicitly that there might be a signal of harm among patients who are not that sick. So these are the ones who do not require oxygen. So the thought is that you could have some immune suppression there. So what we learned was that patients who needed oxygen, and really especially those who needed to be mechanically ventilated, these are the people who had a pretty impressive improvement. The patients who were intubated, really a 40% death rate without dexamethasone and just under a 30% with. That's a huge difference when you think about it. Slightly less exciting on just the folks who needed oxygen, 26% versus 23%, but hey, you know what? A 3% reduction in mortality is a big deal when you're looking at a problem like COVID-19. And then lastly, let's do remdesivir. Actually, by the time I'm recording this, we know more than we knew in the August issue, so I'll update you there. And remdesivir was, of course, this big hyped thing, was supposed to be a game changer. Turned out that the mortality benefit kind of wasn't that exciting. So we saw in the preliminary data several months ago that there was really no mortality benefit. Maybe they were hoping that once they had more patients in, they would have enough of a signal to get that. And by the time we published this in ASAP Now, we didn't see that. But now, since then, we actually have the final report and still no statistically significant mortality reduction from remdesivir. But remdesivir does seem to help a few people get home sooner. So of the people who would recover, remdesivir is shown to help them possibly recover more quickly and get out of the hospital sooner. The problem, of course, is, are we going to be giving it to everybody and keeping them in the hospital for longer IV courses? And okay, so a few people went home earlier, but actually more stayed longer because they got remdesivir even though they didn't need it. So let's talk about who doesn't need it. Everybody except one group. So nobody needs this drug. It doesn't help anyone, except it looks like very clearly patients who need nasal oxygen, supplemental oxygen, maybe a mask, but not BiPAP, not CPAP, not high-flow nasal cannula. We're talking just simple oxygen. These are the people in whom there was a reduction in length of stay among the people who recovered. So 15 versus 11 days or 10 days or so. And that's great, gets people out of the hospital. But again, I want to point out that if they don't need oxygen, or if they actually need BiPAP, if you can do that in your hospital at this point, we're now seeing that that's probably safer than we realized, or high-flow nasal cannula, let alone intubation, those people should not be getting remdesivir because it won't help them. And we're really concerned about, really on the lower end, the folks who you could send home, but you'd say, well, maybe I'll give them remdesivir. Now you've admitted them to the hospital for no reason whatsoever, and you're not shortening their length of stay. You're making it go from they didn't need to be here to they're here for 5 days for a 5-day treatment course. So we want to make sure we're using this on the patients who are admitted needing oxygen, because the hope is that we can decrease our capacity and, of course, send patients home sooner. That's always a very good thing to do. All right, let's move on to the next topic. This next article is by Dave Barron, who is a FaceApp and a longtime emergency physician. And I love this article. It's called Stethoscopes and Hearing Aids, Tips for Choosing Devices to Improve Poor Hearing. And we think about emergency medicine as a very young person's kind of game, but think about this. First of all, there are people who are practicing later and later in their careers, and so hearing can be an issue. And there are folks who come into the profession with hearing differences so that they might need hearing aids. And when it comes to using a stethoscope or using anything else that would require listening, there's a lot of options. And I found this article to be informative from the perspective of if you needed to think about this, and also just inspiring to think about problem solving. And so what David did here was really looked through a bunch of different options. There's an open fit going behind the ear. There's a standard fit, sort of like your custom ear mold that you might picture for a hearing aid. There are more in the ear and in the canal options, and there's ones that are completely in the canal. They're so far in, they're invisible. And what he did was he kind of looked through and tried different things out with different stethoscopes, and some have adapters and some do not. And I just think it's interesting because if you're thinking about the future or your present, it's nice to know that someone has thought about this and has gone down this path, and that we can really have our workforce be strong, because we don't want to have any counter incentive to people doing the job they love to do. So I'd love this article. Check it out. That's right there in the August issue. And let's keep moving. I'm going to fire through a bunch of our articles here a little more quickly. That first deep dive on COVID I thought was good, but let's talk about a few in a little bit more rapid succession, starting with Kids Corner. The pediatric section of ASAP Now always gets a lot of attention. We always have people on our survey saying, give us more pediatrics. Because if you're like me, you see kids, but maybe not as many as you saw in residency. If you're not in a pediatric ER or working in a place that doesn't have one, so you're just getting all the kids. So let's talk about one of my favorite sort of myths in medicine, in pediatric medicine, and that is doxycycline for kids. And I think we all remember that doxycycline should not be given for kids. That's the myth or the dogma or the feeling or the teaching, because it could stain their teeth. And so when it comes to certain diseases, maybe like Lyme or other things, we aren't really giving doxycycline routinely to children. And so let's look at the data, because that actually may not be the case. And this all started back in the 1960s with some studies showing that maybe tetracycline was staining kids' teeth between the age of 2 and 8. And so we're not really sure about this. So a blinded randomized control study by Volovitz et al. Looked at 61 kids aged 8 to 16 for dental staining of their permanent teeth after having received doxy for asthma. Just keep in mind, though, that permanent teeth do calcify really starting after 5 years. And so the remainder of the permanent teeth, with the exception of molars, should be completely calcified by 8 years. And the study actually looked at 31 kids who had gotten doxy treatment prior to the age of 8 for asthma, actually, of all things, which I don't think we're doing too much of. But in any case, of those who got doxy prior to the age of 4, there were 21 of those kids. They also had controls in the study, which I thought was nice. And it turns out that really the samples are small, but no kids in either group showed any demonstration of permanent tooth staining. So if this happens, it's not routine. Another study to support this was a retrospective cohort study that looked at Native American children ages 8 to 16, looking at their permanent dental staining, or if there was any, following treatment for Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is another indication that I think we do think about for doxycycline. And these were kids, on average, their date of exposure, or their age at exposure, was about 4.5 years old. So if it would have happened, it should have happened. And similarly, even though the courses were about a week long, there really wasn't any sign of a problem. So can we give doxy to the kids? I think the answer is probably, possibly. I certainly would run this by a pediatrician. Of course, we don't know if every 1,000 times this happens, and what's our risk tolerance here? Is there a good alternative? But sometimes when you're really looking at this, the alternatives are pretty weak. So you might as well go with the thing that you know will work, and you can be assured that this dogma from the 1960s about staining and tetracycline may not be as scary as we were taught and that the boards makes us say. Another Kids Corner article, again also by same authors Landon Jones and Richard Cancer, is looking at what age to start swabbing kids for strep. And take a look at this, but basically at the end of the day, they are finding that group A pharyngitis is really uncommon in kids under the age of 2 and maybe even 3. And so testing those kids may not be really useful, especially when you think about how painful it is for you and the kid to get a strep test like of a 0, 1, or 2-year-old. That's really not easy work, right? We know that we're like holding kids down or putting these swabs in the back of their throats, and it's just awful. And so why do it if it's not necessary? So take a look at that also in Kids Corner. While we're doing pediatrics, let's stop and do a little bit from our column Casted, which is a really nice column written by Aaron Sayal. And I really enjoyed editing this just because we all know that looking for a pediatric elbow fracture, we're supposed to know the mnemonic CRITOE, C-R-I-T-O-E. But let's be honest, other than that, sometimes I forget what it really means. And the idea is that the ossification in kids' bones happens in a very explicit and predictable way, and it happens in order. So you know that if there are not any sort of ossification centers left over, these little holes or these floating bones, then anything you see would be abnormal. So you can know, looking at the images, what should be there, what shouldn't be there. And there's an age correlation, but in general, the most important thing is knowing the order of ossification, because it does follow that. So you could easily undercall or overcall something if you weren't aware of that. I'm not going to go into it, but I think it's just a great pictures, and we have more online as well. And so check out CRITOE so that you know what that is, other than just saying the word CRITOE every time they ask you about a pediatric elbow fracture. It's like, CRITOE? I think that means something. But of course, we know that that's capitellum, radial head, the internal or medial epicondyle, the trochlea, the olecranon, and then the external or lateral epicondyle. That's what CRITOE stands for. And of course, the idea is that that's the order in which ossification should occur. And so look for that. Okay. Let's take a little break from everything clinical and talk about policy. One of the things I love about ASAP Now, I think, as I've been editing this now for, gosh, over a year, is we really try so hard to balance clinical things and policy things. The college does a lot of work on policy, keeping us afloat, fighting for our rights, fighting for our livelihoods. And we also do a lot of work in terms of committees, in terms of what's the latest and greatest on clinical medicine. So we're always trying to balance that. And I think that's an advantage we have really in this space. I'm really proud of the magazine, so thanks for reading it. So let's talk a little bit about, but before we do that, let's talk about one of my favorite features that we do. Again, it's not clinical, but I really like it. It's called the Residency Spotlight, because this country is really full of great residency programs, great hospitals, and we like to highlight one just about every month. So this month we had a spotlight on the University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center Case Western Reserve University Residency, and they are on Twitter at UHCMC_ED. And this residency program is a 3-year program, about 12 residents a year, founded in 2008. Really strong on medical education. Some of their research looks at that, like how good are they in terms of their lecture assessments, and also things like the ultrasound skills at the bedside. So I think that there's just a lot of great education going on there. So that's our residency spotlight for the month. Let's talk about some ASAP policy. I think you all know that we've got great ASAP staff down in Dallas, plus all the physicians who are involved too. And the COVID-19 pandemic and the crisis has really given the ASAP staff a chance to really step up for us, and I'm really appreciative of that. So we've got a great article here called ASAP for You, with you on the Corona coaster. And let's just talk through a couple things that ASAP's been doing for us. Pushing for PPE, it's a big thing. It doesn't just show up overnight. It takes a lot of effort, hard to do it alone. So that's been going on. Also, expanding access to care through telehealth has been a big thing. The fact that we can perform medical screening exams via telehealth is actually was not a gimme. That was not like a no-brainer. That actually took work. And so ASAP was really involved, and it's been in constant contact with CMS advocating for that as a major policy change. And at the same time, also talking to HHS and other stakeholders about liability protections, because we are not doing things as we normally would, especially during a COVID spike or surge. You can't be doing the same as usual. You can't be just sending these low-yield ACS workups to OBS that you don't think they need it, or they might need it, but it's not nearly as bad as the downside of taking up that bed or exposing them to coronavirus. So it's nice to know that ASAP's got our back here so that we can safely deviate from the usual practice to keep our patients safe. This is not about denying people services. This is about saying this is the safest thing for you and for everybody. Lastly, there's been a big push on mental health, really important stuff. We are so not in this alone, even though it sometimes feels like that. And we do have an article also about Dr. Lorna Breen, who died by suicide, and we all have heard her story and what an amazing person she was, and she was really the best of us. And so when we hear that story, we think, what's wrong? Is it the system? Is it that we're not supported? Well, it's a little bit of everything. And we know that this is something that we can't ignore. So ASAP is very supportive in terms of the mental health resources we have, and also just covering these issues. We are not shying away from that, and we want to make sure that we do the best we can for each other. So that is ASAP for you. Moving on, I'd like to direct your attention to an interview we did with Susan Sidori. She is the new executive director of ASAP, and she is coming into this role with a lot of experience. She was the executive director of the Society of Interventional Radiology. Now, I don't know much about that organization, but I know that it's probably not as big as ASAP, but it probably does have a lot in common with us in terms of you really have to advocate for physicians and you have to know physicians. And I've worked with Sue a little bit now and can tell you that she is just extremely professional, really smart and experienced, and has a lot of wisdom to bring to this role. And we did this Q&A just to let you know a little bit more about who she is and what she's about. And I think that she really has her mind around some of the big challenges that face us. And I can't think of a person just on the first meeting or first couple meetings we've had who really exudes competence and confidence, but also approachability. So I really think that we did well here. And check it out. It's on page 18 of ASAP Now. We got a little bit into Sue's past and what she thinks, how we can leverage our current position and our current challenges to actually emerge stronger than we were before. And one of the things that I think that I wanted to know from Sue was just how it's going, because she started this right in the middle of a pandemic. And I wanted to know what was one of the things that had really surprised her on the job. And I don't think that she was surprised by how welcoming everyone was, because I'm sure that during the recruitment process, that was obviously part of our culture. But I think that what really has stood out to Sue is just how seamless it's been. My sense in talking to her and reading her responses and also just working with her is that she feels welcome and that she feels like the baton has been passed very smoothly. So there's not this like, oh, this is how we do it and we don't like the way you're doing it, but really just a great transition because of an understanding of where we're coming from and where we're going. So that's really exciting. Excited to work with Sue. And I think that she's going to be a person who is going to really figure heavily in our success in the coming years. I'd like to end this episode with a little coverage of Coding Wizard. This is a mini column that we have on a regular basis. And it's one of those things that just kind of gets stuck into the magazine. You might miss it. It's so small. Just a little corner of one page usually when we do run it. And it's one of those things where you think, okay, just an ICD-10 code change here and there, or maybe something about the CMS fee schedule. Well, honestly, there's sometimes these are really important things and you could really help in terms of your RVUs, but also just in terms of even just CDC, like figuring out what's going on. Good data is really important. So I'm more conscientious about this because of this little space called Coding Wizard. And one of the things I thought was really worth covering this time was that Michael Lemansky has a column here, and he mentions that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, actually has been really trying to help with paperwork and getting rid of duplicative documentation, that is having to do the same thing over and over and over again. And actually there has been some movement in this space. And one of the recent changes that is really important to highlight is that CMS has widely broadened who can document in the medical record. Not really so much what needs to be documented, that is something that we'd like to see change in some areas, right? But changes in terms of being able to verify a student's note for documentation and billing purposes. So that's really important that we can actually now use those. Now, the medical record still has to show that the teaching or attending physician was present for all the services, but it's really important because we don't have to duplicate everything. And actually, this can include medical students. It can include PA students you might have, if you have any nurse practitioner students. Now, there's a whole issue about whether we should be training people outside of emergency medicine. Not going to go there. But what I am going to say is if you have these students around, you can actually go ahead and attest to their documentation. And if it's done correctly, it could really save you time. So I'm always about that. I'm always about how can we reduce our burden. So Coding Wizard coming up with great information on how to reduce our time sitting in front of the computer so we can be with our patients or sign out and get home to the things we want to do other than medicine. Although we love doing what we do, we also love doing the things outside. That's what makes us emergency physicians. That wraps up ASAP Nowcast for the month of August. and check out the magazine. There's no possible way I can get to everything we cover. We've got great stuff from policy prescriptions to more ultrasound in terms of nerve blocks. There's always something. Great pictures, great layout, great stuff. It's also online, of course. Get it in your inbox at home or at work, but also on the interwebs. So thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. I'm Jeremy Faust for ASAP Nowcast. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.